Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Casterbury's podcast with a kicking cur. My name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Casterbury's.com and I am one of the three hosts of the podcast with a K. With me, I like to say as ever, but sometimes we don't have a full team, but I'm delighted to say that Brian Turnover and James McLean are here today. Hello, guys.
Hello. Hello.
So we're going to, that's my keys. I'm just jangling them in an extremely unprofessional podcasting manner. This week on Casterbury's podcast with a K, we're going to be talking largely about the new Spearhead from Space Blu-ray, which has recently come out and is rather spiffing. But before we get to that, there's a couple of other things we want to get through. First of all, thank you from us and from Rick Lundeen for your support and downloading and viewing of our Daleks Master Plan comic strip, which has been hugely received across the interweb. Comments on Casterbury's in the comments on Facebook, comments on Gallifrey Base and on a couple of the Restoration Team website forum, as was. There's the Rhubarb one as well. There's hundreds, dozens of places been talking about it. It's gone down extremely well. And hopefully what's going to happen is it's going to be turned into book form for children in need, raising money for children in need. However, it will not be cheap because we'll be looking at 170 pages or so. It is looking promising at the moment, but we'll have more on that in future weeks. Guys, did you enjoy Dalek Master Plan comic strip version of?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good. I'm delighted. Okay.
No, it was very good.
It was.
No, very impressive.
It was very good. And it was done as a labour of love, really, by Ricky. Started 2 years ago. So, and I'm hoping at some point to get him on the podcast, probably as a, you know, as a pre-recorded interview or an inserted interview of some sort, to discuss it a bit more in depth. But until that happens, big thanks to Rick for doing something pretty awesome, really. And speaking of awesome, hey! Casterbury's magazine, the print copies have been ordered. So if you are one of those lovely people who have purchased print copies of Casterbury's magazine, they will be winging their way to you, within 30 days, but hopefully within the week. And we're hard at work on Casterbury's magazine issue 2, which will be a more specialised production focusing on Doctor Who video games and speaking to some very interesting people. Mm. Anything to add to that, James?
I think it's a great topic because I think video games is very interesting and Doctor Who is very interesting. You put the two together, you get something which is, kabam. I don't know. Yeah, what was that?
Kabam.
Kabam. K-bam.
K-bam. K-bam, of course. What else?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, then.
We're really missing a canine in here. I was thinking that in the introduction.
What, we should have a canine?
Well... Yeah, I'm not quite sure how our canine would be because you'd obviously have to have the emphasis on the K rather than the canine species. So.
Well, canine?
Yeah.
It'd be a K-shaped robot?
A K-shaped robot dog?
No, it wouldn't be a dog. Oh, why would he be a dog? He's a K.
Okay.
God.
I'm just saying, you know, Doctor Who. There's a couple of interesting TARDIS-y things that we've been looking at in the new Casterbury's in last week. And this is, you know, we're kind of into TARDIS building in a way at Casterbury's. We've, both of you have built TARDIS's in your various ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, in particular, Brian has built a TARDIS. Or a police box, let's be specific. You haven't built a bigger on the inside space-time machine. You've built a police box.
Yes. That, I'm working on the inside. The inside right now is proving a little bit more difficult, to be honest.
I can imagine it probably is. Yeah.
Had it built, though, it was probably more apt. I did my part to help, but I had a master carpenter do the actual carpentry for me because
did he have a goatee beard?
The skills. Sorry?
Did he have a goatee beard, this master carpenter?
He did not. He was more of a Yana master. Okay. Yeah.
I built a TARDIS and... Well, I built it in the future, actually. Proper TARDIS. Used it to sort out your past or your futures.
Oh.
Yeah, terrible futures you did. Christian was a dirty man. Dirty man on the streets he was. led an unwholesome life. Right. Needles followed wherever he went, a trail of them.
Thanks.
Used and horrid. And I came, well, that, exactly. And I came back, created a TARDIS. It could only do two jumps, came back, sorted your life out, got you into Doctor Who.
Right.
Brian was far worse. He was a Stargate fan.
I can only imagine trying to build the Stargate.
Oh, you should have seen
where
it.
Where would you keep it?
It was terrible. You weren't even a good Stargate fan.
Oh, really?
Sellotape. Ring pulls.
You have saved my life.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is possible that James has had a liquid lunch today. So if we push on.
I did actually. My first TARDIS I ever built was when I built two when I was in my younger years. Mm. My first one was, do you remember the Doctor Who technical manual?
Yeah, yeah.
That had a.
I'm looking
bit
at it right now.
Yeah, there's the bit at the back, isn't there, where you could cut out and actually create quite a nice little police box.
Yeah.
And then there was another one that was a Build Your TARDIS, which was a sort of a bigger Doctor Who release in the late 80s, which was, it looked a little more like the Logopolis TARDIS. Nice. Again, it was the same sort of thing, but a sort of bigger, sturdier structure. Might be worth looking for, see if I find any pictures of it on the internet. But that was quite a nice build. And because obviously at the time, until DePaul, and between Dennis Fisher and DePaul, which was my children years, there wasn't any police boxes to build. So they were the only ones.
Well, there was possibly a third way. And this is one that I didn't have it, but I wanted it. And my mum bought it, but unfortunately something else came, which was you could get a sort of a TARDIS tent, a police box tent. From catalogues and maybe some shops. And it's basically a wooden structure with a PVC over the top. Mm-hmm. And then some probably sticky Velcro doors or something like that to go inside. And then there'd be buttons on the wall which bore absolutely no resemblance to the time rotor. However...
Wouldn't really keep a Cyberman out, would it?
It wouldn't, no.
That Velcro.
Or indeed a Gelf or anything, really.
Dalek. Dalek might have problems, to be honest.
Well, perhaps. Velcro, yeah, if you put it under... Well, if you put the PVC under the Dalek, it possibly can't move.
Oh, well, there's that. I was just thinking PVC door... Velcro doors are a bugger for Daleks.
Yeah.
There's no way to get traction.
There was no way to find out because this isn't what came. What came was a small... Actually, more resembled a time... rotor, to be honest with you. It was a small space capsule, four-sided triangular thing is what actually came, that also required blowing up because it had kind of like a triangular structure, so the ends and the base had to be blown up so it would stand up. So there was no sticks involved, but it wasn't a police box. I was mortally disappointed. I ended up putting the thing up.
Yeah, but that's the point. Because you see, what actually sent you onto your filthy drug habit was the fact that you got that police box tent and you got into Doctor Who at the wrong time.
Right.
And you got very disappointed over the whole Colin Baker shebang. And when Time and the Rani hit, you were, there's just nothing left of you.
So what you're saying is you got a job at Marshall Ward on the day that my mum rang in this order?
Well, yeah. Come on. How else would I do it?
So you're saying that Stargate ruined Christian's life as well because he ended up with a pyramid?
Well, it could have, wouldn't it? It'd have been. It shows the whole interlink web of time.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
Does it?
How the two of you are bonded in a weird, presumably
Wait a minute. So another thing that you have done is take both Christian and I from the points of our life when we were children watching Stargate and shunted us back to the 70s. So that we could be children during Doctor Who instead.
Well, I mean,
you've actually stunted our growth in a bit because we, right now, we could be old men, older men. We are older men. We could be younger men. Younger, that's what I meant to say. You know what? I think you saved my life. I'm not making any sense.
Yeah. So anyway, moving on, TARDIS building. There's this fantastic lady, Yoz Creative on YouTube, and we've linked to Oncast Derbys, and you'll find it in the show notes for this week's podcast. And she's done a stop motion of her construction of her police box, and it's a beautiful police box, and it's difficult to describe exactly what it is. You really do have to watch it, but I think what it does underline, chaps, is how difficult the job is, and she appears to have done it single-handed as well.
Yes.
She definitely did, yeah. And it's an impressive build. I don't know if she's ever tried to build anything like it before. I know both her and I belong to the same TARDIS Owners Club on Facebook.
Okay.
So I saw some of the progress in another video. I think the BBC had interviewed her at one point as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, definitely. I mean, if you watch the video, it's pretty clear she did do it by herself. I mean, every step of the way, it's just her. And one thing that impressed me was having a police box and putting it together, especially the roof. That's not something you want to do alone. But there she is, trekking that roof on top, you know, standing on her art table and pushing that thing on top. So, you know,
nearly falling
major kudos to her. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at that. It's an art table. It's built a tilt,
yeah.
You know, and she's standing on the thing.
Well, you see, this is Residence as well, because originally, before Brian got into Stargate, he was actually into Doctor Who, and he actually built a TARDIS police box. The roof fell on his head because he did it by himself. So I figured, you know, better get him into Stargate because it'd be better than Doctor Who because it's clearly dangerous. But then I saw episode of Stargate and I had to go back and get him in Doctor Who again because clearly while it was more dangerous, it wasn't quite as boring.
Right. James, have you been watching Back to the Future this week?
No. I'm just riffing. I'm ad-libbing. You know how you do, surfing the wave of words.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. No, I think it's good. I mean, I thought what was interesting about her police box is it has a sort of slightly feminine touch to it, I think, which could be a dangerous thing for me to say, but it's got a sort of it has a lot of shape to it that you can feel.
Type 40.
Yeah, I didn't quite mean like that, but yeah.
Oh. You should have seen the gesture I did with my arm then, or maybe you shouldn't have done.
No, perhaps I shouldn't. You don't want me having to go back in time and having to correct your time stream to make you a little more polite. But
perhaps I do.
It just has a little more, because it's a smaller as well. Maybe that also helps, because obviously she's done it to fit into a room, so mm-hmm. the size of it isn't quite large. But there's quite a lot of emphasis. The lamp's quite large by looks of it, even when the camera's tilt, when you see the shots of it at more of a play eye level. You know, the bottom plinth is quite wide, so there's quite a lot of shape. So it looks quite a nice structure. It's not quite as boxy as men's stuff is. Men's stuff tends to be very, very functional, doesn't it, by archetype? Wow.
Let's contrast it then, in as much as we can, with the transforming 3D printed TARDIS.
Yes, good idea.
Which is very man stuff, I suppose you might say, because what it does is essentially it transforms from a police box into an Optimus Prime. This is a chap called Andrew Lindsay, and again, we'll give you the link on the show notes so you can have a look at this yourself. And basically what he's done is used a 3D printer and printed out all the components that he designed in order to create a 3D, a transforming police box. And it looks remarkable. Apparently it doesn't stand too well. 3D printing is kind of looking like it's going to take off either this year or in the next couple of years. And it looks astounding. He's even put a little dicky bow on it.
How does 3D printing actually work?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. Not really. Basically, it does it in layers.
Okay. Right.
So, for instance, if we're looking at the picture now of the Optimus Prime head, what it would have done, it would have started with the neck level.
Right.
Okay. And then it would, the next pass over, it would have been slightly wider, and it would grow each part out. And then as by the time it gets to the top, it would only drop on the two ears. Prime's two ears drop on the plastic for those two. So it does it in layers, essentially.
That hasn't helped me at all.
It essentially, they take a plastic block, if you will, and they, you know, you make a 3D object in a computer. So you have like a 3D rendering that is the shape and proper measurements that you have laid out on your schematics. And then you have another kind of electronic mill, which is just what they call a 3D printer, but it's like a plastic mill. And you put in a plastic block, and it just trims the shape of the plastic until it matches the 3D printing.
No, that's not 3D printing. That's milling.
It's still 3D. Okay.
Well, no, 3D printing is printing. It's actually printing the plastic onto a surface.
So it's not actually cutting a block.
It's not cutting a block, no. That's an option. That's something that you can do, but 3D printing strictly.
That's how our lab does it, but go on.
Strictly speaking, 3D printing is actual printing of... it might be plastic or it might be metal, and there's a bio application of it as well, although that's for hospitals and labs. So instead of printing ink onto the paper, you print plastic onto a surface and then more plastic on top and on top and on top and top until it builds into the shape that you're looking for.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Oh, it's interesting. Well, I'm sure the listener wasn't too aware, so I'm glad I did highlight that and show my ignorance.
I mean, I think Brian's description is a valid description of 3D printing, but the type of 3D printing that's kind of coming along now is the layered approach as opposed to the milling I think the milling has been around a little bit longer and has been more affordable a bit longer.
It's kind of weird that it builds it up in layers like that. It's just, I mean, especially since you say with metal as well. With plastic, I can kind of get, you can kind of heat it as you go along.
Yeah. But I don't think domestic ones are, I don't think there's metals available for domestic ones. Here in the UK, a company called Maplin, a shop called Maplin, has been selling DIY 3D printers for the last few weeks and months or so, a short time. Basically, I mean, you've got to build a printer yourself, and then once you've done so, you can start 3D printing stuff. But, you know, the plastics can probably be quite expensive. So what you can, what the applications really are, jewellery and game pieces, I would imagine.
But this is kind of interesting, isn't it? Because, and quite scary, perhaps, for people like the BBC, because you can, if you're printing 3D images now, 3D images you can actually build yourself, whether it's, you know, in simple things like Blender or SketchUp, or in, you know, more complex ones like 3D Max and the like. And then you obviously, with your own, you can actually build your own police boxes. You can build your own, to a certain degree, if you're good, you can build your own character, or you can import, certainly. I mean, I know that's what a lot of people can do, especially people who rip off computer games, you know, and the like. You're just thinking, you know, for licensed material, it becomes harder to make it attractive if people can make such good stuff with limited effort. And they can customize as well, so they can make it as they like it.
You know, the thing is, though, too, with that is, despite, you know, with it becoming easier to do, people were always going to go ahead and make their own anyway. It's just that more people are probably going to be available to the process, because the one thing that I know, being in the prop world with all the replicas in my collection, is that fans make more accurate props, replicas, than the officially licensed
merchandise. Oh, definitely, yeah.
And so, you know, it is nice that you'd be able to do this stuff, and if you are a collector with the proper amount of money and the know-how, that you could build this stuff in your own home, and rather than have to get on these group runs, you could actually iron out all the details yourself, you know. And some replicas are really nice. I mean, obviously, Nick Roboto has made, you know, the $4,000 Matt Smith sonic screwdriver from QMX. And, of course, it's going to be nice because it's made by Nick Roboto, but it's $4,000, you know. But for the fan like myself, who doesn't quite have that much for that, these private little group runs where people put their expertise to work to make a certain amount at cost so that, you know, they want one. But it costs a lot to make one themselves, so you go ahead and you make a group run where everybody shares the cost, and basically you just all pay for your prop and you're done. This 3D printing thing would be fantastic. The only issue is that, I mean, if you look at this Optimus Prime, while it's extremely impressive, you can see all the dimples in the plastic. So if you need something that's smooth, you're going to have to find a slightly different process. But it actually works for this because it looks nice, like it's mimicking wood grain. Which is just a luxury of it. It just happens to work well for this process.
I think when the process is more developed, I wouldn't be surprised to find, like, in 20 years' time that we don't buy toys anymore. I think it'll be like software and bits of plastic.
True, and even
That's
then, as you say, I mean, when you're working with groups as well, so, you know, if you're into something, you'll be sort of either sharing your own personal costs. Things will become more independent and personal projects, and it just depends on how you distribute. It's a very interesting and quite scary, looking at quite a scary change to the medium of real objects and software, digital experience. And it is actually quite a mailbox, may I add, as well. Quite boxy.
And it's Optimus Prime, which, you know, he's kind of a big hero for the lads as well,
isn't
he?
He's the man, isn't he? Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's push on. Because what we really want to talk about this week, although everything we've talked about so far we find fascinating and hope you do too, dear listener, who may be listening on Stitcher or Audioboo, so hello to you if you're using either of those methods, and perhaps even YouTube if I can get my finger out this week, is Spearhead from Space, the fantastic 1970 serial in which we first met John Pertwee's Doctor. We were reintroduced to the Brigadier and UNIT. We first met Professor Dr. Liz Shaw and the Autons and the Nestine Consciousness. And it's just come out on Blu-ray.
Blu-ray!
Yeah, indeed. I know there is a reason why it's come out on Blu-ray, and that's because it can, whereas every other classic Doctor Who cannot. Spearhead from Space was the only one recorded entirely on 16mm film because there was a strike on, basically. And plans for the episode would have been entirely scuppered if the producer hadn't taken the route of and the director hadn't taken the liberty of doing the entire thing on film, which has enabled the BBC to release it in considerably upgraded quality. Now, I've seen it, Brian's seen it, James hasn't. So, like the companion in an episode of Doctor Who, James is going to be your way into this, dear listener, if you haven't yet seen Spearhead from Space. So, Brian, first of all, what did you think of the quality?
I thought it was beautiful. Yeah. You know, I was surprised to see something from that era of Doctor Who be able to look so nice. And I don't know if it was seeing the extra quality or not, and especially since hearing the strike story, which honestly I'd not heard before. I would be very curious, as much as I don't want to lose this story on Blu-ray and full film, I'd be very curious to see what they would have done had they shot it on video. Because one thing I noticed watching it in Blu-ray was how cinematic it actually comes across for the era. You know, it looks like movies of that era because there were so many different angles and so many different setup shots that they ordinarily wouldn't do in a Doctor Who episode that I recall.
Yeah, well, I think that's because film cameras were lighter than video cameras of the day, weren't they?
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
Like, what? How much would that have changed? Because this could have, if you edited Spearhead from Space into one movie like they used to do when all the Doctor Who episodes came here, it actually probably would have worked. It really has that look. And especially now on the Blu-ray with that film quality, it really... And, you know, I want to go back and check the DVD and just see if it still appears that way. But it seems like it was never cleaned up quite as much as this before, even though, despite the fact that even for DVD, it could have been.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd love to see that. It looked very nice to me.
Now, James, you haven't seen it.
No. Last I saw it was on VHS when it first came out in the $9.99 range back in the day. So it's probably been, that's over 20 years. 20 years. Well, no, I have seen it since then because I had it on VHS. Yeah.
Mine was $7.99, I seem to recall, from W.H. Smith.
Was yours
around the same time.
Yeah, well, they did go down. And then they did re-release it on VHS, I think, as well. I'm not sure. Oh, maybe they did. I can't remember. But yes, I remember it back then. And I must admit, when I watched it, it never occurred to me that even though I now see it in my head that it was all done on film, it never struck me when I first watched it, probably because I was quite young.
Mm.
And I imagine a lot of listener like me would possibly be a bit like that, not really realize until someone says, hang on, you notice that's all on film.
Yeah.
And obviously the time you notice it, generally speaking, on Doctor Who is obviously either moving over to the film studios for certain parts.
Yeah.
Or the difference between obviously the video and the TV show. It's TV. But there was none... Was there no sets for this one because of the strike? Was it all location?
I think it was nearly all location. If it wasn't, it was like dressed location. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it does have that look to it that it was all location. Like even the area that they use as units, temporary headquarters, it all looks
that was a BBC training college,
structures.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, James, actually. Before they had mentioned, and I think I had remember hearing it before, but it's not something that like really... stuck with me because it, at the time what sort of actual difference did it make, but I don't think paying attention to it and watching it I had ever noticed that it was all on film either, which is odd when you consider stories like The Pirate Planet where you can clearly tell when they go from video to film.
There was
nothing in this story ever watching it before that had any kind of odd differences like that.
Well, that's interesting because I've always, and I just want to go back and say it's the hospital that's the BBC training place, I think. I've always had this thing where there's certain people who can tell and there's other people that can't, and I don't know why they can't, but there's people that can tell when an episode of Doctor Who or any classic TV footage switches from video to film.
I mean, the easiest way to tell, if you don't know, listener, is basically look at the top of people's heads. If they have a shiny light glow on the top of their head, it's quite likely they're inside the studio
or an Auton,
and you've got a lot of studio lights there. If they haven't, then they're probably not in a studio, not in a video filming studio. Which for the I mean, it's a very basic one because you can tell the whole tone, quality, everything changes.
Sometimes the whole look of the film. I mean, a lot of times the in-studio work I like to liken it to home video. It looks like something you might have shot at home, whereas film work generally has grainy is a terrible way to say it because it makes it sound like it's poor quality, but it's the best example I can give right now. It has a different texture to it. It looks more real, more cinematic.
Blake Seven used to suffer from it in a few, especially in the first season, because they would have occasionally go and shoot some of the Liberator stuff in one of the film studios. And so you've got two identical sets, you know, those hexagonal corridors and the like, but the film quality keeps changing when they go into certain rooms. And there it becomes really noticeable because, as you say, you've got the same locations, but with different qualities.
So, Invasion of Time in the TARDIS.
Yes.
Is another example.
And Planet of Evil, whenever you see the forest settings that they have of that planet on film, it looks amazing. You know, that episode really looks great. But then when they walk into one of those spaceships, it looks like a set. I wonder if film would have made the set. I wonder if film would have hid that kind of look of the sets if video gave away too much.
When did they stop using film in Doctor Who? So far as going over to the film studio
in the 80s.
I was just trying to think, what was the last episode I can think of where it's very clearly moving over to a film studio?
Well, the Seeds of Doom was entirely recorded on VHS.
Right.
On VHS, big fan, on videotape, even the external stuff. But it wasn't until Colin Baker, when they started permanently doing videos, dropping the film entirely, and I think it's in the Trial of a Time Lord season.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I think I remember seeing a lot of.
I think it's the Mysterious Planet. It's Mysterious Planet. Obviously, there's the film bit at the beginning, the model shot of the space station, or that TARDIS being captured. That, well, the Mysterious Planet, I think, is when it starts. Because before that, previous season, two Doctors did shot on film in the bits they did in Spain. So it's got to be then.
Oh, interesting.
But back to Spearhead.
Yep.
Because we get to see this whole new reintroduction, this big, brand new look for Doctor Who. And, you know, this is, we've possibly spoken about this before on Costello's podcast, and we've certainly spoken about it on the website. Spearhead from Space is the 1970 version of Rose.
Yeah.
In terms of what it represents for Doctor Who, it's like a completely new start for Doctor Who. There's no regeneration sequence. It's in colour, whereas, you know, in 2005, it, you know, we already had colour, but it was like a brand new star for Doctor Who. And we've got the same villain as well, essentially. So there are certain parallels there, but it's also, it does that important job of introducing a family. So in Rose, we get Jackie Tyler and Mickey, and in Spearhead from Space, we get UNIT, it's not the first time we see UNIT, it was the first time we see what UNIT really is. And what it's going to be in Doctor Who. And so we get quite a lot of Nick Courtney in there. It's also the beginning of Series 7, which has a lot. It's very different to any other Doctor Who, isn't it, Series 7?
Yeah.
So you've got Spear from Space, you've got the Silurians, you've got the
Inferno.
Inferno at the end, and I'm trying to think of the one in between. Ambassadors of Death, thank you. Which are very different to any other Doctor Who. And it's almost as if the film, and it's, you know, it's completely an accident, but this film aspect to Spearhead from Space, make the fact that it looks and feels like a film, sets you along this sort of Quatermass-like path, which, you know, is already intended with the writing, which I've always found fascinating. Been a big fan of Series 7. Go on.
It's funny because the 70s are sort of bookended by a very serious approach to Doctor Who with Mid-Mead in 1980 for the last season of Tom Baker. And as you say, the Spear from Space, Terrence Dix, lets sort of carry the show into quite a serious and, as you say, Quatermass is a perfect parallel. And yes, in the middle it gets a bit silly, but those two bookend really quite serious, and there's a lot of integrity there. Interesting the Rose and Spear from Space comparisons, because, I mean, again, you've got very different ways of pitching Doctor Who to new people, which is a lot of what the 70s that Spearhead does. It does sort of work on the assumption you, the audience, might not know who the Doctor is as much as people who have got this unknown man in their bed. do. And it's a very different approach to how they did it with Eccleston. And both of them work, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
One with a very active doctor and one with a fairly inactive doctor, which started to become the trend, actually, when it came to regenerations. A long period, which is quite clever in a way, because it keeps the audience on their toes.
Yeah.
Wondering what this doctor is going to be like.
It does. Well, that's the other thing as well about it. And I think Brian will agree with me here. When we come to the, it's, you know, it's 40 years on now, 43 years on, and we're looking back at Spearhead from Space, and we're looking back at a classic doctor who, you know, back in the 80s, we would easily sit there and recount our list of doctors: William Hartnell, Patrick Charlton, John Pertwee, Tom Baker, Peter Davison, Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy, if you got that far through the 80s. And, you know, there are a list of names that you just reel off, and you've got all these classic doctors. And there you go, you've got the two in black and white, then you've got the ones in the 1970s. And, you know, in the 80s, a lot of the 70s stuff was still only available in black and white. And it's very easy just to group them in as the old doctors. Well, really, John Pertwee was completely different to the two that went before him. Strikingly different. He was a completely different actor. He'd come from a completely different area of the acting profession. He wasn't a serious actor like Patrick Charlton. He wasn't a character actor. He was a showman, performer. When he acts, he performs. And there's a brilliant documentary,
yes,
about John Pertwee on the Blu-ray, which kind of underlines this. And it's the only thing that's wrong with it, I think, to me, and Brian, you can talk about it in a moment, is that it seems to have been produced before this MI5, MI6 stuff came out in the papers.
Sure,
so it mentions that he was on the Hood, HMS Hood, mm-hmm. And then got transferred. But it doesn't go into any of the Fleming stuff, unfortunately. But regardless, it's a very good watch.
Yeah, I was going to bring the documentary up myself just because it is very interesting, his whole life. And I agree, it is a shame that it was made before that. But I don't feel that it necessarily suffers. I mean, it certainly would be enhanced by that. But I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was very well done. And it was very interesting to get all the insight from everybody that he had known. It was probably one of the most genuine ones I had seen.
Mm.
You know, it was just very well put together. And he led a very interesting life. He just seemed like he did not like to sit still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Katie Manning's on there. David Jacobs as well is on there, the British broadcaster, who was also an actor in his early days. And a couple of other people. It's really worth watching. I think Jeffrey Belden's on there too. It covers Wells of Gummidge as well as Doctor Who, and it covers his early life. And to be honest with you, you've probably seen Spearhead from Space, and you may not be that interested in seeing Spearhead from Space again, even if it has been polished into a state that it could never be polished any better from. However, this documentary and the one that follows, which is about Caroline John, are definitely worth watching, I think. Definitely worth the cover price.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one thing I was going to say was it did seem like it was rather slim on extras, but when you watch this one, you know, just getting the clarity of the story, all the cleanup, and just, I will say I've noticed a heck of a lot more things in this story than I ever did watching it on VHS or DVD before, and maybe it was because I was paying more attention because it was cleaned up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I found that to be a very interesting thing, which made it feel like a refreshing watch after seeing it so many times. So if somebody maybe thinks they aren't interested in seeing it again, maybe they would be watching it with a different mindset. I didn't really, like, after seeing that special on John, I actually, oddly enough, it didn't make me sit there and go, like, there must be more on this DVD. Is this all there is? I actually felt really good after it, and I just thought that was really cool.
It was very warm, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's got Jeffrey Beavers on. It's got their daughter on as well. And I think her brother and sister, Caroline John's brother and sister, are also on it, which is quite in contrast to the John Pertwee one, where there's no family members on the John Pertwee one.
Yeah, right. Good point.
So it was about the Autons. I mean, just going back to the story, as you've been talking, I've just been thinking about, because I'm thinking about when I watched it, because I was probably about, 15, 16. So, you know, Doctor wasn't something that was really scaring me anymore. But I remember the Autons were very intimidating in that story, in a way, actually, that was different to, say, Terror of the Autons, where they are quite horrific. In this one, they're quite oppressive. Possibly simply for the employee who the Auton just follows, almost in a sort of Terminator-like
Ransom.
Fashion.
Yeah.
Yes, with little emotion.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And that is quite horrific, because, I mean, again, that's where Terminator, the film, gets its fear factor, is the fact that it's meant to be unstoppable. And for a large degree in this, well, they are. They are literally unstoppable, which they never really carry through in either Terror of the Autons as much, or, and certainly not in the new series Autons ones, which is possibly a shame. You don't get that feeling of indestructibility.
You possibly do in Pandora Opens, I think. I think the fact that they're everywhere, you get that feeling, oh, blimey, there's a bit of trouble here. But in Rose, I don't think you do. The way that they stop turns, suddenly you get this sort of like comical clock music when they're disabled, don't you? Which really spoils it.
Yes, definitely.
You know, staying on that, actually, I will say that I do kind of agree with James a little bit more. Like, I don't feel it in the Pandora Opens. Not to discredit them. They were good moments for them. But the reason I say that is because one of the things that I noticed on the Blu-ray was the two Autons that actually took the doctor from the hospital in the beginning of part one of Spearhead from Space. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Blu-ray that I could actually see the plastic makeup effect they had put on those two.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know why, but, you know, I guess I had kind of thought, like, what's his name? Hibbert, the guy who worked at the toy factory. Maybe I have the wrong name, but anyway, he wasn't an Auton. He was just kind of being controlled by them.
Yeah. Mm.
So I had kind of thought, oh, well, maybe that's all it is. These two guys are just being controlled as well. But until you actually see the Blu-ray and you can see the plastic work on their face, the way that you can the general later on in the story, it makes it a bit more freaky, because kind of like the moment in Rose when they made Auton Mickey, granted, they probably made him a little too plasticky. Yep. But I like the fact that they made him plasticky, and I like the fact that they made these guys plasticky, because you look at somebody and they kind of maybe have a bit of a plastic tone to them. I don't think anybody sits there and goes, wow, I'm talking to a plastic person. They just sit there and go, what is up with their face? What's going on? That to me is a bit more freaky when something comes out that, like, they're not human. You notice something was off. It's like Douglas Adams writes with Ford Prefect, you know, the way he describes him in the book. You know, he's got wiry hair and his skin is pulled back and stretched tight and his eyes don't blink normally, you know, but we don't notice it because we're just humans and we see another human that's just a little weird, you know, and that to me is very interesting. So I like that aspect, and I kind of miss that. Like, when you get the Autons in the Pandora Opens, they just look like humans. Yeah, there's no plastic element to them at all, and I do miss the fact that there's something a tad off about them.
I think that's because they are mannequins, aren't they, in Spearhead? And I totally agree, actually.
But the two guards that take Pertwee in the beginning of the story, they're not mannequins. I mean, look like humans. They look like the Autons from the Pandora Open.
It's like in Terror, it's like the policeman in Terror of the Autons, isn't it? He's a policeman at first, and then the doctor pulls his face, and then
I suppose you could argue, if you were to argue against Brian on that, as you were saying, the mannequins, they did come from a mannequin factory. Maybe it's a certain cheaper type of plastic. Maybe, you know, maybe if they'd actually... You know, if they came back 40 years in the future, they could just be using 3D printers, couldn't they? It should be far easier. You'd notice a slight grain, but...
certainly the technology could have been improved. You know, obviously that can always be argued. That could be the easy way to just accept it as well.
But your point
I think what it is, story-wise, I just think it's more interesting when there's slight element that's off. Yeah. But people are noticing it, but they're tending to ignore it just because, okay, you know, maybe this woman put her makeup on a little heavy today. You know, maybe this guy's been sweating. Maybe that's just sweat and not plastic skin. You know, like you try to justify it. You try to talk yourself out of the oddities, which is interesting. To me, I like that.
Yeah. The other interesting thing about the Blu-ray is that there is another extra on there. It's possibly the most hardcore of extras ever. It's basically 30 minutes... or nearly 30 minutes, of test runs for the John Pertwee era opening titles. Mm-hmm. Have you watched them all, Brian?
I started going through them. I was about maybe a third of the way through them.
Yeah.
They did seem like they were going on.
Yes, I know. And I'm usually quite fascinated by opening titles, but I do think, blimey, I think I'll have to skip through this a little bit, I think. I tell you what, there's plenty of opportunity for fan films to use those.
Nice.
Because it's all completely bare, isn't it? It'd be really good to see someone do something with those.
There are two other things about the DVD or the Blu-ray that struck me, though.
Okay.
I'll get this one out of the way first, because this is just an interesting observation, kind of like what we were talking about, the parallels between Rose and Spearhead from Space. I never really quite paid attention to this before until watching it, and what had happened was, when I had watched Spearhead from Space, I was actually watching at the same time Planet of Spiders, because I had actually started that before the Blu-ray came in.
Okay.
So I was kind of watching them both in parallel, like one at night as I was trying to fall asleep on the computer, and then the other one on my TV.
You fall asleep now, on your computer?
I do. Your TV?
It's comfortable. You guys don't do that? It's like a cat. It's great.
I'm gonna say, are you a cat?
Right.
A K-at.
A K-at. Yeah. Well, obviously, it's like a Kit Kat. Yeah. So, what you have is, at the beginning of Spearhead from Space, the Doctor comes stumbling out of his TARDIS and falls into the bushes.
Yeah.
At the end of the first episode from Spearhead from Space, he comes out of the trees, gets shot, and stumbles into the bushes. And I thought, look at that. They bookended episode one with the Doctor falling nearly in the same spot. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and I said, wait a minute. You get to the end of Planet of the Spiders. The last thing the Doctor does, along with the first thing that the Doctor does as John Pertwee, is stumble out of his TARDIS. And I thought that was very interesting that they did that. And I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but it's very interesting. His era, and it's on opposite sides too. It's literally like they tried to bookend his era with him stumbling. You know, he came into this world stumbling into it, and he's going to leave the same way. I don't know. I found that very interesting.
As a prop guy, Brian, do you find it uncomfortable in Spearhead from Space when he falls out of the TARDIS? He almost pulls that door off.
Yeah. Let me tell you, when I had my TARDIS at Wizard World at the comic book convention just recently, the amount of people that go in there, and they've got backpacks, they've got bags, or when they're coming out. Listen, they made the new series TARDIS wider for a reason, and part of that is because they wanted you to be able to see what was inside the doors for their visual effects, and also partially so that they didn't constantly have to have the actors walking sideways out of the box and banging into the doors. Well, imagine how many people go in and out of the box all day long and smack those doors and judder them around. And, you know, like, you cringe every time. You know it's going to happen, so you accept it. And I'm not angry at anybody for doing it, because it's going to happen. I'm going to do it, you know? But, man, it is an odd feeling. And when you see it on screen, I don't know what they build those boxes out of, but they're like rubber doors, because when you take the door out, it pulls out and then snaps back just in the bottom portion, not the whole thing. So it is a tad freaky when you see that, the abuse that poor box gets over the years. But my other point, I don't know how it was for you guys, because I believe the rights issues may have only affected us here. But when I got to the episode in the toy factory, when they used the Led Zeppelin song,
Fleetwood Mac.
Fleetwood Mac. Yes, yeah. My mistake. It's the first time I've ever seen the episode with the song intact.
Oh, of course, it was removed, wasn't it, on the last?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was weird. So while I'm watching the Blu-ray, all of a sudden this song starts playing, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then I remembered, obviously, that song had been removed for rights issues before.
Yeah.
But it was so jarring, because I'd never heard it that way before. It was not on our VHS. It was not on our DVDs. It may have been aired on PBS here, but, you know, I was too little to remember it.
Yeah. This is from the Peter Green incarnation of Fleetwood Mac. So this sort of like obviously predates the more famous version of Fleetwood Mac with Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie. Just a little bit of rock history for you there, dear listener. I can't imagine the episode without it, to be honest with you.
Well, it's so weird. So like, have you had it in every incarnation, or did they?
It's been on every version.
It's so weird.
The Beatles in the chase, that was removed for the DVD version, if I remember rightly, but is on the VHS version.
No. You guys have the Beatles on the DVD, because I bought
oh,
the
right.
UK DVD.
Yeah, we didn't.
Specifically for that, because it was removed on ours.
Right. So who have you got on yours?
They just cut the scene totally.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, what they did was
there a scene in a coffee, a milk bar or a coffee shop in another series?
Yeah, Remembrance of the Daleks.
Remembrance of the Daleks, yeah.
Yeah, so we just have, for us, we have just 60s-ish sounding songs. Right. I don't know if they're real or not. I've never really done the research on them, but yeah. Which I also have the UK DVD of that.
How convenient.
Yeah. Well, you know, The Beatles being removed from Remembrance of the Daleks wasn't as bad to me as the chase, so I borrowed a friend's and I just made a copy of the episode that was there so that I had it, you know, just because I wanted to have it originally how it was. With the chase, I made sure I bought it to have completely, because if it doesn't ever get the rights issues sorted here to be properly released again with that scene intact, then I don't want another US copy, because it just seems so wrong that that moment is gone. You know, you go, you see Lincoln and you see Shakespeare, but then they just cut it straight to the next scene.
So you lose Ian dancing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, that's dreadful. That's
and you wonderful. Lose the continuity error with Barbara and Ian actually knowing who the Beatles are.
Well, that's fortunate, I suppose. Well, look, I've just cracked up a couple of interesting facts about the production of Spearhead from Space.
Yeah. Okay.
As well as being a lot of the filming at BBC Wood Norton, which is this training facility that they had, they also recorded some in a pub, apparently, although I'm not sure which part. But what I really like is the working title of the serial, this is from Wikipedia, the working title of the serial was Facsimile and was based on a story that Robert Holmes wrote for the 1965 film Invasion, which featured an alien crashing in the woods near a rural hospital where a medical examination reveals his alien nature. The hospital is later visited by other aliens seeking a fugitive criminal. Some of the exact lines of dialogue used by the human doctors to describe the physiology of the injured alien were reused.
So this was an unmade script, you said, or it was actually something?
It was based on a story Robert Holmes wrote for the 1965 film Invasion, which I'm just going to bring up, which was written by Roger Marshall from a storyline by Bob Holmes. So it was a film that was made.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I would as well.
And, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, they've borrowed over the years. I mean, especially you get to...
Well, especially Robert Holmes borrowed a lot of
exactly.
stuff from his own stuff. He's reused some of his own things, and he's borrowed from the old Hammer and from the American horror movies as well from the 30s and 50s.
And I was watching The Pirate Planet the other day, and, you know, we know that Douglas made The Hitchhikers in a radio series, and then when he was working on Doctor Who, he was adapting it for a book and I believe also the TV series at the same time.
Yeah.
But you get in The Pirate Planet, and when they go down that corridor, which I love that scene when it's that, now I forget what it's called. It's
sort of like inertia corridor thing.
Yeah. And you have Tom going down the hallway, and he says he'll never be rude to an electron in a particle accelerator again. And it reminds me of the I'll never be rude to a glass of water again thing that Douglas Adams uses in The Hitchhikers. And it's his script. So it's just like they keep the same themes. They are the same writers. They have the same ideas. And, it is interesting. So there's going to be bleed over like that, especially if maybe something was way lesser known and not very well received, but you think it's a good enough idea to go ahead and run with again. Moff did it in the new series, you know, with his own stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Actually, speaking of Douglas Adams, I discovered his daughter's on Twitter.
Really?
Yeah, and she seems to be quite an amusing young lady.
Good for her.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I read, she put something along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing, took the dog to the park to play frisbee. It was rubbish. I need a flatter dog. Which I thought was rather lovely and amusing. And I think maybe for the listeners' benefit, I'll just link to.
I just noticed actually, thinking about it, I mean, there's that line in Christmas Invasion about Arthur Dent and the dressing gown.
Right.
And then you have Ulan Khalufid's book in Destiny of the Daleks, which the Doctor's reading. I didn't never connected the two of them. Really do put Hitchhikers in the Doctor Who universe, don't they?
Which means Blake Seven's also in there as well.
Blake Seven is also in there, actually, isn't it? Through Corpse Marker.
Yeah, and hang on.
Is it?
The same. Corpse Marker. Yeah.
Same there's also Blake Seven, so this is new to me.
There's also, as I mentioned in the Transforming TARDIS article, there's also Death's Head.
Yeah.
Which was Marvel UK comic, which the Doctor appeared in. Seventh Doctor appeared in. And Death's Head came from the Transformers comic, which means the Transformers are also same part of the same universe.
And also, just to make it a little worse, Death's Head also then went on to meet Iron Man and the Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
Pushing them into the Marvel universe too.
Yeah.
I was going to say Doctor Who got pushed in the Marvel universe anyway. I mean, it was made by Marvel. I don't know if there was necessarily a crossover, but he's there.
Well, there's that. I think in the Death's Head series, when the Doctor meets Death's Head, I think that's, I might be wrong because it's a long time since I've read, but I think that's on top of the Baxter building.
Yes, it is. He leaves him on top of the Baxter building.
Yeah.
So there's that as well. But yeah, I mean, the... what was the one you just met? Yeah, sorry, Corpse Marker, just for Brian, has the same character. The puppeteer from the episode Weapon appears in Corpse Marker, which is the Robots of Death. Chris Boucher, obviously being the Doctor Who writer and a Blake 7 writer, took his character and brought him over.
So it's the same character. That's
same character. Yeah. So technically, I think Lance Parkin manages to wedge Blake 7 into the something like 3000 or roundabout. Then where
it's
actually
Frontier in space. It's that area, isn't it?
Yeah. He says that there is a Federation expansion around there. You could justify as being Blake 7 territory.
Yeah.
So now Colin Baker technically matches Peter Capaldi with two appearances in a Doctor Who kind of connected TV show.
Yeah.
Babe and the Butcher. I love Babe and the Butcher. Babe. He does sound that well. Babe, my mother used to call me. Babe.
Oh, and Peter Davison. He was in Hitchhikers.
He was, yes.
So there you go. You know, lots of Doctors popping up everywhere.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what. That's a very interesting note for us to end this week's podcast with a K on, I think, because we've given automatic recommendations there beyond the Blu-ray version Spearhead from Space. Our listener can go off and find, look up all these different appearances.
Just actually a recommendation on my part, because we were talking about comics. It's a long story, but a few years ago for French trade a magazine, they wanted to do a licensed Batman insert, 12-page insert to go with their comic trade magazine. Mm-hmm. And they came to me and I wrote one and coloured it. By the time we inked it, sent it over, the editor had been fired or had left. I couldn't work it out. The French was bad. My English was bad for French. And they hadn't acquired the DC license. So we just last week or so, we put it up onto a website, which is a 12-page Batman comic.
Oh, excellent. Are you going to give us the link and we'll include that in
we'll
the show
notes? Yes,
we'll
put the link in there. But that's just something I did a few years ago. And I say it's up there. It's worth it. It's just a comic-y thing, as I say, for free. Fan thing in the end.
Excellent. Oh, I'll be having a look at that when you send me the link.
Certainly will.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's the end of this week's Casterbridge podcast with K, dear listener. Thank you for joining us, as ever. And we hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye. Obviously, we won't see you, because that would be freaky.
You had a liquid lunch.